How seriously do we take coming into the presence of God? What went into your preparations just to be here this morning? Last week, we looked at Psalm 27, and we looked at a man whose life was in crisis, David. And despite all of that, he said there was only one thing, one priority he had. I'll read it to you again as a reminder. One thing I ask of the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. He was surrounded by life-threatening crisis. David's one desire, nonetheless, was to be in the presence of God. And for him, that was in the temple, most effectively. The house of the Lord. The house where God dwelt, where he would come and see the presence, the glory, the holiness of God. That was his one desire. Well, I want to encourage you this morning to reflect on what that might be for you. I want to go right through the Bible and see just how God's people met with him in days gone by and had serious encounters with him. So let's begin with the old forefathers of the Christian faith. People like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses. How did they come to meet and have an encounter with God? They could hardly knock on the door of the local church, could they? Because they weren't there. How did they do it? Well, usually it came through one of these, a theophany. Doesn't sound very exciting. But wow, they must have been exciting. Do you know what a theophany is? A theophany is a manifestation of God in some really tangible form to human senses. Put really simply, God visibly appearing in some form, often but not always in human form. That was often the way that God encountered his people. So I'm going to go through a few examples to remind you of some of these rather dramatic theophanies. The first one, Genesis chapter 12. This is Abram being called as the Lord literally appeared in front of him. Let me read verse 7. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I give this land. What a dramatic encounter that was as a starter for 10. And the response? So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. And we later find that that place is Bethel. Come to that in a minute. Let's move on. Genesis 18. Do you remember that occasion when the three strangers appeared on Abraham's doorstep? They literally appeared and he invited them in. Two angels and God himself appeared before him. It was the occasion when he invited him to stay at the camp where he and his wife fed them and entertained them. And this was right before God told Sarah that she was going to have a child, even in her old age, within 12 months. And it was right before the incident where God would judge Sodom and Gomorrah. These are dramatic instances. A theophany. Let's move on. Genesis 28. Jacob, do you remember he had a dream? A rather dramatic dream. The stairway to heaven, or Jacob's ladder, as it's otherwise known. Jacob dreams that there are angels going up and down from heaven, up this ladder. And he is this key component in all of it. You want to know the details? Read the passage. We should read our Bibles much more. There's so many stunning stories in them. Let me read what happened after this encounter. When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place?" Do you get the sense of what is happening, the magnitude of these occasions? He went on to say, "This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven." And early the next morning, Jacob took the stone he'd placed under his head as a pillar and poured oil on top of it, and he called that place Bethel, which was the house, means house of God. Jump forward. Genesis 32. And now Jacob has another encounter, one of the most bizarre encounters you'll find in Scripture. And he wrestles with what appeared to be a man, but was actually God. The situation is that he's about to meet Esau. Remember, Jacob has cheated Esau out of his birthright. They are not good friends when they part company. This is the first time that they've met, and he's dreading meeting Esau. But God informs him that this is going to happen. And so Jacob, terrified of what may happen, sends his family away, his whole family, all of his belongings, and he stays all alone. And this is what we read. One tiny verse that seems just unbelievable to read. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When did that last happen to you? That was the situation when Jacob was renamed. He was renamed Israel, which means to wrestle with God. Another dramatic encounter, theophany. And he met Esau. Everything went really well. They went on their way. And we read, there he too set up an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. Mighty is the God of Israel. Such was the encounter he'd had. Here's another theophany that you all know. Most children know this one. We've moved on to the beginning of Exodus, and Moses is called by God from a burning bush. A bush is ablaze, but it's not being consumed. And there's a voice coming out of it that calls to him. You want to know the details of all that calling, when essentially he called Moses to release his people out of Egypt? Read the passage. But what I want you to note was what happened afterwards. And God essentially said to him, "Don't come any closer. Take the sandals from your feet, because the ground on which you stand is holy ground." Here's his approach before God, and it is holy ground. And he can't just tread lightly towards where God is speaking. And the final one I want to mention, Exodus 24. The Ten Commandments have been given, and all that was dramatic in that. But I want to go to Exodus 24, a few chapters after the commandments were actually given, where God confirms his covenant and gives him the stone tablets. This is what we read about this particular encounter coming into the presence of God. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. You are to worship at a distance. But Moses alone is to approach the Lord. The others must not come near, and the people must not come up with him." And he got up early the next morning, and guess what he did? He built an altar. And a little later we read, when Moses went up on the mountain, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai. Can you begin to imagine what that must have looked like? And for 6 days the cloud covered the mountain. And on the seventh day, the Lord called to Moses from within the cloud. This is no casual encounter. This is not to be taken lightly. He was in the cloud for 6 days before God even called him. And to the Israelites, the glory of the Lord looked like a consuming fire on the top of a mountain. And my head cannot get around what that must have been like. And if this simple image, I'm sure, doesn't begin to do it justice. But I've given you those because I want to get a sense of what was happening when God met with those people. Did you recognize the kinds of criteria that were taking place, the things that were happening common to all of them? These were not a casual approach to God. These were personal encounters with Almighty God. This was not just a religious following. They were personal encounters. It was a place of holiness because God was present. Therefore, it resulted in approach of reverence. We read constantly of awe and fear being the things that are present. They were entering the presence of God. God was physically present. Consequently, they saw the glory of the Lord. And their only response was a response of worship. They almost all built an altar. Such was their move by being in the presence of God. So I ask you the question again. How seriously do we take coming into the presence of God? Well, it's all good and well for these mighty figures from the Old Testament to come into God's presence one at a time in these rather dramatic ways. But what about the rest of the people? It wasn't God's intention that just these privileged few should get to know him. He wanted his people to come and know him too. Do you remember what God announced to Moses when he called him to bring the people out of Egypt? Well, I'll read the words to you. He said, "Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and a mighty act of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God." This is no longer God speaking to just a few individuals. God is now taking ownership of an entire nation. So if God is going to speak to an entire nation, how on earth are they going to meet with him? Surely not through a theophany of the old type. How does God meet with an entire nation? He gives them a tabernacle. "Then have them make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them. Make this tabernacle and all its furnishings exactly like the pattern I will show you." That's Exodus 25, verses 9 and 10. "Do this exactly as I show you." Do you notice there are two words in there that are quite significant, that are different? The first is sanctuary. That's a place of holiness. It is a consecrated place. This is not some cheap community hut. It is a sanctuary because God is going to be there. But more than that, it is a tabernacle. And a tabernacle is a name for a dwelling place. And it will be God who will dwell in this dwelling place. And if you want to read the details of what this will involve, then read on the next chapters, 25 and 26, and start to see the links between words that we saw and themes coming up with the theophanies and the things that would now happen to a whole nation of people in the tabernacle. Read about the ark of the covenant, the table, the lampstand, and so on. And here it is. This is an artist's impression of what it would have actually looked like. This vast area, the outer area, God was going to dwell in the heart of his people. And the 12 tribes were literally laid out strategically, all in the right place, all around. But there's this vast courtyard separated from the sin of the world outside by that curtain all the way around. But in the courtyard, plenty of space, plenty of room for the processing of animals, for sacrifices, for people to adequately approach God seriously. There's only one entrance, and it's on the east side. It faces east, so that when the people come in, they will be facing the tabernacle, facing to the west, the absolute opposite of the sun-worshipping pagans who look to the rising sun in the morning. And so God would dwell among his people. And when God was present, there would be this cloud, this pillar of cloud during the day, and a pillar of fire at night that signified the presence of God, just like we saw on the top of the mountain. And this is the way in which God would dwell with his people as they set out on the journey. And if in the morning they woke up and the cloud lifted, they would pack up everything and they'd be on the way to the next location. Why is it like this? Well, I missed a little bit out because, of course, some other events have taken place. Do you remember that when Moses went up the mountain, he was only away for 40 days to receive the Ten Commandments. And what happened? Well, he'd been away for 40 whole days. They couldn't possibly cope. So they melted down their gold and they made it into a calf. And they worship the calf. I suppose 10 generations of Israelites being in the company of Egyptians, and they'd adopted their practices, and they had some to have something tangible to worship. So God gave them something tangible, and he lived and dwelt in their midst, and they could see where he was. But of course, that's just the outer area that I've spoken about. Then you look in the center, and when you look past the people making sacrifices and all that's going on there, is the holy place, the true tabernacle, the tent, laid back, sending a message to the people that God is holy. You don't just get to walk up just like that to the living God. So the tabernacle is laid back in the compound. But then the tabernacle itself is a remarkable thing. Not anybody could go into that. Only the authorized priests could go into the holy place, the tabernacle. It's a reminder of that holiness. And then when we look at the detail, here's another image that shows you how it was constructed a little better. That inner area was covered with four separate coverings, each of them having a meaning. The first, the innermost layer, was woven with finely twisted linen of blue, crimson, and scarlet. Do you remember? Similar to the way the reading that Margaret gave us just a few minutes ago about the temple, exactly the same colors, all with meaning. And then embroidered beautifully, fine work, with figures of cherubim. Why? Why are the cherubim on there? Let me read to you what happened after Adam and Eve had rejected God in the Garden of Eden. Genesis 3, verse 24 says this: "After he drove the man out, he placed on the east side of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword flashing back and forth to guard the way to the tree of life." That elaborate, beautifully ornate inner cloth with the cherubim on is the thing that you see on the inside, where the presence of God would be. That's the bit that is the demarcation between the holiness of God and the outside world. Then there's the second layer. And the second layer was made of a coarse goat's hair. A goat. Cursed animal. The animal that was a sin offering. That's that coarse layer that's on the outside, not visible from the inside. On the outside of that is the third layer. And this is made out of ram's skins, dyed red, significant. The red, the colour of blood, the colour of sacrifice. And that layer gave another, outer, tougher protection from the outside world. But then there was the outermost layer. That gives the ultimate weather protection, if you like. When I grew up, I always believed that that was badger skin. I was told it was badger skin. I really struggled with that a little bit because I like badgers. Badger skin? What, really? Thinking at the moment is that the authorized King James Version that used to say badger skin was probably translating a Hebrew word that sounded similar but was different. Your translation of the Bible, if you read from the NIV, says sea cow. It's the skin of a sea cow. People translate that as the skin of seals, porpoise, dolphins, some say even manatees. We don't know. And the latest translation of the NIV just says a durable leather. The point is, it was there to be protective, not beautiful. Not beautiful to look at from the outside. Does it remind you of anything? Isaiah 53. He grew up before them like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him physically. But inside is the holiness of God. This looking forward to Jesus. And then there's the curtain at the front. Let me go to this diagram that cuts open and allows you to see what's inside. And you see that front curtain. Those same fine colours. And you shall make a screen for the doorway of the tent of blue and purple and scarlet, of fine twisted linen, the work of an embroiderer or skilled worker. This could not be more elaborate. This is not trivially approaching God. Every layer, everything, even the hooks, the way the tent covers are held down, made out of solid gold. All of it precise. Because inside was the holy God. And ordinary people could not enter that holy place. Just authorized priests. But in your diagram, you see that there's another inner layer. You see this blue curtain. And that's even more special. Same colours, very similar. But that is the demarcation point of not just the holy place, but the most holy. The Holy of Holies, as it was called. 15 feet wide, 15 feet long, 15 feet high. That was the place where God's presence would be found. And that curtain has one difference from the outer one. It's embroidered again with cherubim. The significance of that protection, the holiness of God inside it. And even the priests couldn't go in there. Only the high priest. And the high priest only on one day of the year, the Day of Atonement. Only then could he go in, and only taking in sacrifices. And before he could go in, elaborate practices that had to be gone through. He had to be washed thoroughly. He had to wear completely new clothes. He had to take with him an incense to allow the smoke to protect his eyes from the holiness of God, which was inside the presence of God on the Ark of the Covenant. Do you get the sense of how seriously God takes our approach to him? How seriously do we take coming into the presence of God? That's the tabernacle that God gave. But what after the promised land? Before they ever got to the promised land, God spoke repeatedly to the Israelites. Before they ever arrived there, he said, one day I will tell you about a name where I will choose to place my name, a place of permanence. And it was 300 or more years after this before that became possible. And God announced to David that that place would be Jerusalem. And God wanted in Jerusalem a more permanent structure. So he built the temple. David was the one who first thought to build a permanent house for the Ark of God. But because his hands had shed so much blood, God wouldn't let him do it. He was not fit to be able to do it. And if you were listening to the reading from 2 Chronicles 3, you'll recall that this temple was so much more elaborate. It was a whole, altogether a grander scale. And this daunting task, therefore, fell to Solomon, David's son. But David prepared the work. He subdued all the enemies of Israel so that the nation of Israel could be at peace when this temple is built. Even the building of the temple needs to happen in the right circumstances. David was the one who amassed huge quantities of gold and silver and bronze and iron. Some people have calculated that there were some 3,000 tons of gold in this temple. And then all the timbers of cedar and so much huge stone that was built into it. And it's much bigger. The courtyard, I've not shown it in its entirety, but that was all dressed stone too. And then around the outside of the courtyard, and remarkably elaborate. But even though the structure was stone, it still had to be lined with wood, because it was men who had made the stone. So it was lined with wood. But now not the acacia wood from the temple, because acacia wood is what you find in a desert. No, this is cedar wood brought by boat from Lebanon, the best that they could get. But wood on the inside of the temple isn't even good enough. So now it all needs to be overlaid with solid gold. None of your gold leaf rubbish. This is solid gold put into practice all around. On the floors, the walls, the ceiling. Can you imagine what it must have been like to be there? And now there's another curtain. And this curtain supplements the cloth one. This one is made of a solid material. It's wood that folds, that opens up, but again covered in gold. And I'm not going to start to go through all the detail of the ornaments around, all that had significant meaning, and how much silver is there, and the bronze and everything else. But do notice, again, in the Holy of Holies, in this area, these enormous cherubim, made out of olive wood this time, but overlain with gold, and the Ark of the Covenant, which would be the presence of God in the center. 183,000 men took 7 years to complete this. But you know what one of the most amazing things about this whole construction process? During the entire construction, not a single hammer blow or axe blow or any other tool made of iron was heard banging. Not a single blow in the area where the temple was laid. Read 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 7. And it tells us that all the stone was hewn and all the timber was cut in advance by 80,000 craftsmen elsewhere, cut to precision, and then, only then, brought and assembled in this location where it was built in near silence. Why? Because God is holy. And the intent was that people would come and see something of the magnitude of God. Do you get a sense of the standard, the absolute standard that God had? How seriously God sought to teach his people that he alone is God and he is holy. How seriously do we take coming into the presence of God? But God's still not finished. I'm sure you're aware that the Babylonians completely desecrated that temple. That's a physical temple, and it's gone. Completely destroyed, as the people of Israel, who had rejected God and done things their own way, were taken off into captivity. That was rebuilt, not quite probably to the same standard, and not for quite the same reasons. And that too was completely destroyed, this time by the Romans. But God wasn't content to finish, even with an amazing building like this, because God wanted you to be able to walk into his presence. And you could not do that in that temple, and nor could I. So he did something about it. And he did something about it in Jesus' sacrificial death on a cross. That's what made it possible for us to come into his presence. I wonder whether we miss the verse in the account of Jesus' death and crucifixion that gives us the reason for that. Let me read it to you. Matthew 27, verses 50 and 51. And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. And at that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. 60 feet of temple cut straight in two. The significance? Because Jesus had taken upon himself the sins of the world. When we trust in him, that made it possible for us to walk through the curtain, to have access to our holy God. Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain that is his body, let us draw near to God with sincere hearts in full assurance of faith. Did you come here this morning? Come to share communion with a sincere heart. How seriously do we take coming into the presence of God? Do you realize that we have God's Spirit within us? John chapter 1 says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. What did God do with the people of Israel? His chosen people, he dwelt among them in the tabernacle. What did Jesus do? He came and in flesh, he dwelt among us. And he goes on, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. It used to be a different word that is used instead of dwelt. The King James Version used to say, and the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. That's what Jesus did for you, for me. The house is no longer a physical one made out of rocks or even gold. It's a spiritual one. You are living stones being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood, to offer a spiritual sacrifice acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. And it has burdened my heart this week. And I felt I needed to say to you, as his church here in this place, how seriously do we take coming into the presence of God? do we understand what Jesus has done? But do we understand the holiness of God? And it doesn't matter. You know, this building is nothing. I really don't care if it's not here tomorrow. But what the significance is that when we gather, where two or three gather in my name, there am I in the midst. Your God is with you right now. Did you prepare yourself to come this morning? Will you prepare yourself better next Sunday, on Tuesday, on Thursday, when you come together with your brothers and sisters in Christ? When you have a quiet time, will you prepare? Because you are coming into the presence of God, and he deserves all that we can bring to prepare ourselves to receive from him. May God help us to recognize his holiness.